Welcome to winter, this is just the beginning. But we come here in the morning, Shelag v'Hermon.
That's warm news. Shelag v'Hermon. Wonderful. Bakasha. Hermon, in the Hermon. Hermon. Right, not far from here. That's always a good sign. That's where it starts. Okay, today we're going to do what might be considered the classic subject of science and Torah, and where they clash. And where they clash, I mean, is that a certain halakha is based on a certain scientific idea that we know today is incorrect. So where does the halakha stand? A halakha that's based on clearly incorrect scientific information. And this is the class A act of that whole discussion. Because I'll try to give other examples where indeed there are certain scientific pieces of information that are the backbone of certain halachot, and sometimes that information is correct. Sometimes almost correct, nearly correct, sometimes incorrect at all. The question is how we deal with it from a halachic standpoint. Are we in a position to adjust the halacha in light of new information? So before we get to the page, let me say a word about the Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, who was a 13th century biblical commentator from southern France, known as Provence. And unlike many of the Chachmei Ashkenaz who were busy growing grapes and making wine, Chachmei Sfarad, the Sfaradim were into science and philosophy. The Chachmei Provence, which is between Spain and France, they were more into being Ashkenazim in this realm rather than Sfaradim. But Ralbag was unusual, and he was an accomplished scientist to the extent that he was a known astronomer in his day. There is a crater on the moon named after him, Gersonides, the Rabbi Gersonides, which is Rabbi Levi, sometimes referred to as Crater Rabbi Levi, and sometimes as Rabbi Gersonides, which is Gershon, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, which means he was recognized in the scientific world as an outstanding astronomer. My daughter, Ahuva, my eldest daughter, did a doctoral dissertation at Bar Ilan many years ago on the biology of Ralbag, where Ralbag writes annotations to a Greek work on zoology, which in Hebrew is called Miyun Balei Chayim, zoology, animal classification. And what Ralbag does is he comments on it as the book goes. He writes like a Rashi and Tosfot to this Greek work. And it was previously unpublished, which is sitting in manuscript form. And some professor at Bar-Ilan suggested to my daughter this would be a great idea to pick up because she was a BA student at Hebrew University doing some type of integrated degree in science and philosophy. And they opened up a department, an interdisciplinary department at Bar-Ilan University on the history and philosophy of science. Somehow some professor got a hold of her and offered her to bypass the master's degree and go right into the doctoral program, which was a good idea for her, instead of continuing for a master's degree at Hebrew University. So she ended up getting a doctorate at Bar-Ilan on this very subject. And, you know, sometimes when you do a doctorate on a particular subject, there are all kinds of tangents, and sometimes the tangents become more important than what you set out to do in the first place. I can honestly tell you that I've moved myself, my own work at Bar-Ilan on the Rambam. So you get into all kinds of tangential material, and it becomes fascinating, and you take off, and that becomes fuel for articles, for lectures at conferences, and so on. And then eventually you write a book, you know. So my daughter discovered, having gone through, literally gone through, everything that we know about the Ralbag in terms of his comment as a commentator on Tanakh, Chumash and Tanakh. And I say this because just last week there was a book launching at the Yeshiva Malei Adumim of the latest edition of the Ralbag, covering all the five Chumashim and some of the Nevi'im and all of the Megillot. So it's a 7-volume work on Ralbag, annotated properly. It's a scientific edition. So Ralbag was in the news last week. So my daughter discovers that many times in the Ralbag's commentary on Chumash or Tanakh, a Navi or the Megillot, he will augment the understanding by scientific information. He'll say it correlates to a particular scientific point. And so too in his scientific writings, he will sometimes back up an understanding of science with a pasuk in Tehillim or Mishlei or whatever. So he's barking up the same tree both when he writes as a halakha or commentary and when he writes as a scientist. And that's in itself an interesting find, that he's extremely, extremely consistent. So what's the problem? The problem is that it's all based on 13th century science. You're not going to expect the Ralbag to write a commentary based on 21st century science. A lot of it is true, and some of it is clearly not true any longer. In those days, these were scientific truths, but these scientific truths have been rebutted and thrown out. So what do you do with that when the understanding of a pasuk in Tanakh is predicated upon a piece of science that's not true any longer? So I asked my daughter, so what do you do with it? So she said two things. The first thing is, before you study the Ralbag, you say Birkat HaTorah in the morning. Because when the Ralbag wrote it, it was Torah. And you know, she became like a briska. It's a heftza of Torah. That what Ralbag wrote was a shtikl Torah, was a piece of Torah that you have to say Birkat HaTorah on. Whether it's the right pshat or wrong pshat. You know how many times we say Birkat HaTorah on things that were written in halakhic literature that are furthest thing in the world from the truth? Beside that, but at least the intention was to try to understand a line in the Gemara, a line in the Rambam, a particular halakha. Whether you hit it on the nail or not, that's not the point. The point is the process. So the process is a process of Torah. Second thing my daughter said was, Ralbag was so honest that he, in the 21st century, would have changed many of these understandings of the Psukim, and he would have given a different understanding based on more updated scientific knowledge. He would recognize the fact that the way he put it in the 13th century was incorrect. It was not like somebody was just hiding behind and saying, well, science is apikorsis. That's the easy thing to do. And I got news for you. I know people who take that line, that, you know, science is apikorsis. If it's in the Gemara, it's 100% true. So we're going to see a really great example of that kind of thinking. So when it comes to the question of kinim, kinim is little ants, little kinim, little lice. Lice, right. It's like they say in Israel, when at Leila Seder, so, you know, there's a minig when you do the 10 makot, so you take off a little wine from the cup, right? So they do it like this. Dam, tzvardeya, kinim. If you see a 5-year-old girl with a tichel, so it means the kid has kinim. That means that's how they send the kids to Gan, because, or else the gananet won't accept the child back in Gan, because it's highly contagious. So, you know, that's the sign. The kid has kinim. So kinim is something we live with here in this country. There are all kinds of shampoos that you know, are expensive and health garnished, but you do it anyway because Jews are very proactive, and the only way to do it is literally to be a nitpicking her mother and take them out one at a time, and it's very tedious, and you have to do it. Of course, the other way to do it is to give a complete shaven head and try again. You know, that always works too, but you're not going to do that on a 5-year-old. At least most mothers won't do that on a 5-year-old, and you shouldn't. So the idea of killing killing lice on Shabbat, is that permissible at all? So let's just take a step back and say that the 39 melachot, prohibited activities of Shabbat, are all derived from the Mishkan construction. That is a axiomatic truth of the Torah Shebaal Peh. The only melacha activity that's mentioned in Chumash is the transferring of fire. Lo tavahu esh b'chol moshvotechem b'yom Shabbat. It's found in Parshat Vayakel. But that pasuk of lo tavahu esh b'chol moshvotechem b'yom Shabbat is an intro to the building of the Mishkan. Because if you remember, Parshat Vayakel is a repeat of Parshat Truma. It's the implementation of Parshat Truma, the construction of the Mishkan. And from there, Chazal understand that which was necessary as a positive constructive act to build the Mishkan, that's what's prohibited on Shabbat. Fine. So then the Gemara comes up with an interesting list. It's a Mishnah already, an interesting list of 39 prohibited activities. Those are those that are directly, we know that in order to have a korban mincha, a grain offering, you have to have grain. And in order to have grain and flour to bake the bread, you have to plant it and you have to plow the land. So there are 11 steps from stage one. Hey, I want bread. What do I do to get bread? And I don't have the luxury of Angel's Bakery or any of the other bakeries in Yerushalayim. I'm going to start from scratch. I have a parcel of land and I want bread. So you're not going to be able to get your bread tomorrow, but you're going to have some patience. You have to plow the land, you have to plant, you have to irrigate, make sure it irrigates, or get it from Rabban Shalom for free in rainfall. And then it starts growing, and you're going to have to reap it, and you're going to have to winnow it, you're going to have to grind it, and they have to knead it until that dough gets into the oven, and you take it out, and it's bread. You've gone through 11 stations. And if you'd like to see those 11 stations clearly, you visit Neot Kedumim. Neot Kedumim is on the 443 road right after Modi'in. It's a nature reserve that was started by a fellow who's not religious, but very, very knowledgeable, Noga Ruveni. And he set up this reserve of all the flora and plants of the Tanakh and of Chazal. And it's a place that I would take students from Chashmonaim, which was there about a 10-minute drive, to study certain aspects of halakha. And one of them is the area. It's a tremendous area. You can't even do Neot Kedumim one day. It's a tremendous, tremendous area. And you can do sections by. So when they have a whole area, which is called the Seven Melachot of Sidura de Pat, to make a piece of bread, the order of making bread. And there's a patch of where, and of course for kids, there's what's called hafalot, you know, the hands-on, and they have them do these things. They have the tools and so on. So you learn to plow and to plant and this and that, and you get to the, you know, what winnowing means, and you know what grinding means. Every session, until there's a taboon at the end of the day, and you have it baked, and you can go home and eat a pita. Fine, okay, but this is a very good, healthy educational experience. But each of these, so you may say, okay, fine, I cook, I bake, and baking and cooking then halachically becomes related, because you don't cook a piece of bread, you bake a piece of bread, but once baking was there, so Chazal already linked it with cooking, and that's where Bishul comes into the picture. The prohibition of cooking is a corollary of afiyah, of baking. But then the others, you say, well, look, I get my bread at the makolet, I get it at the supermarket. I go to Angel's Bakery and so on. I don't, you know, plow and plant. But the plowing and planting and all the other things, threshing, all have derivatives that are no less d'oraita, biblical prohibitions. For example, dash, dishab, which means threshing. So I'm not threshing wheat to separate the chaff from the kernel that I need to grind then to make into flour. But any type of separation of that level is going to also be an isur d'oraita. So the problem of milking an animal on Shabbat, so that's not part of the 11 stations of baking bread, but milking the cow, there is some type of separation now of the milk from the animal, and therefore it's regarded as disha. It's like threshing. So this is called a toledah. It's a derivative of. And so too, it doesn't say anywhere about irrigation. It says plowing and planting. But of course, irrigation is a stage that's linked to planting. If you don't have rainwater, you're going to have to irrigate. So irrigating is indeed a melacha d'oraita, but it's not part of the 39. It's a derivative of planting. Now there's a statement in the Yerushalmi, without giving us a list, and says that there are 39 derivatives to each principle, each av malacha, which means how many activities in theory are prohibited on Shabbat. Biblically, it's 39 squared, which is 1,581 malachot. I once worked it out. So it's almost 1,600 prohibited activities, doraita. And then first you get onto the rabbinic, and then you get to the chumras, and okay, so Shmirat Shabbat is not a simple matter. Not a simple matter. Again, the Yerushalmi gives us a number, which is just, I think, a very theoretical, because there's no information provided. So what are the 1,581? We don't know. But the we have many, many toledot, derivatives in the Gemara, and they become halachically activated. So where does killing an animal come into the picture? Because in Beit HaMikdash, there is a need to slaughter animals, and they needed to slaughter animals because they required the skins of the animals for purpose of making the walls, the curtains of the Mishkan. So there was a need for skinning animals, and therefore the very slaughtering of an animal is prohibited on Shabbat. And that is called Netilat Neshama. That's the way it's halakhically told. Removing the life, it doesn't mean a soul. Animals don't have souls, but they have a nefesh. So Netilat Neshama means having the life of an organism expire. And that's prohibited on Shabbat. So let's say you can't go to an aquarium and pull a fish out and let it die on the table. That's prohibited on Shabbat. It's called Netilat Neshama. So having said that, now the question is, you got a mosquito that's bothering you. You have a bee in the house that might even be fatal. Of course, you know, people who are hyper allergic to bee stings, it could be fatal. You have a fly, house fly, that's buzzing around and so on. So there are different levels of insects in the house, flies and insects, and that may bother you. And the question is, are you allowed to deal with them on Shabbat, or you just have to say, all right, you know, tell the fly to hang around till after Havdalah, and then we're going to take care of you, you know. If you're still around, you see what you're going to get. Are you allowed to spray all kinds of, you know, spritzes around let's assume there's there are ants coming out of the wall somewhere, so you'd say, all right, you can't step on the ants, and you can't just, you know, take water and just, but let's assume you take a corner where there are no ants there yet, and you spray it with this kind of poisonous spray, and with the great hope that the ants are going to make it to that corner, and they do, and they die an hour later. So is that prohibited on Shabbat? You know, that's indirect already. That wasn't like you spritzing right on them, on the colony of ants. So kinim is lice. But it's going to be a discussion about other organisms and not only lice. So let's take a look what happens here. And I say again, it becomes a class A example of what happens when modern science contradicts the basis, the scientific basis of a halakha. Okay? Source number one is Masechet Shabbat. Tanya, it says in the Braita, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer, Ein horgim et ha-ma'acholet b'Shabbat. Just jump to source number two in Rashi, ma'acholet kina. Kina means lice. Okay, so ein horgin et ma'acholet b'Shabbat, divrei Beit Shammai. Beit Shammai says it's asur. Beit Hillel matirim. Beit Hillel say it's okay. Now you know that unless otherwise indicated in a dispute between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, the halacha is like Beit Hillel. And unless otherwise indicated, Beit Hillel are usually the more lenient opinion. Again, every rule has its exceptions, but Beit Hillel is usually the more lenient opinion, and it's interesting that the halacha sides with the more lenient opinion. There's a Gemara Maseret Beitzah Daf Dalet that tells us why. It says, Kocha dehetera adif. The lenient opinion is stronger, because the lenient opinion must stand up and explain to you why it's permissible. Leniency does in halacha does not mean weakness in Yirat Shamayim, in being God-fearing. That's a late 20th century notion that has independently developed in places like Harnof, Borough Park, Golders Green, and the likes, where if you're a mekel, if you're lenient in halacha, it ipso facto means you're wishy-washy on Yirat Shamayim, on being God-fearing. Somehow or another, Chazal thought otherwise. And they said that to be strict can be basically one of two reasons. One is, you honestly believe halachically that the answer is, it's forbidden. That's it. But you can also have a strict opinion because the halachist is not sure how this decision should be taken. It can go either way. There's what's called a tzad lekan o lekan. It can fall in either direction. And lacking any ability to be decisive, if we're talking about a biblical concern, then a safek to oraita lechumra. If it's a doubt on a biblical idea, then we play it safe and we adopt the strict position. But adopting the strict position is because we many times really don't know how to be decisive. Of course, a strict opinion can also be a decisive opinion, no doubt. And that has to be clearly, explained. But a lenient opinion must always be a decisive opinion, which means the person who's lenient cannot say on a biblical idea, I'm not sure, so let's be lenient. You can't do that. Safek to oraita lechumra. So if you're lenient, that means you have a solid halachic basis to say what you're saying. And therefore, Chazal favored the lenient opinion that was always in a stronger position than the strict position. Because the lenient position is always a decisive opinion, and the strict position might not be a decisive opinion. It might be a doubt, and therefore the lenient opinion can carry the day even against a viewpoint that's strict. So that's one of the reasons that the Gemara suggests why we adopt Beit Hillel over Beit Shammai, generally speaking. And now, what is the rationale for Beit Hillel? So now look at source number two, the second line of source number two. The first line, simply Rashi defined what the word ma'cholet means. It's tkina, it means lice. And now Rashi is going to explain Beit Hillel. Nevertheless, we want to understand why is it mutar, according to Beit Hillel, to kill lice when nitilat neshama, expiring the life of an organism, is forbidden on Shabbat. So Rashi says, kidem mefaresh ta'ama beferek shmona shvatzim. In a later chapter, Rashi says, it's explained as follows. Me eilim me'odamim dimishkan. If you recall, Parshat Truma, at the beginning, Moshe Rabbeinu was told by Kadosh Baruch Hu to summon Am Yisrael to make donations to the Mishkan. That we don't need hard cash, we need material for the Mishkan. Material. And one of them is Orot Elim Me'odamim. So Elim, or Isle, is a ram, and Me'odamim is reddish, from the whatever red hue, whatever, but the skin has a certain red hue to it. Apparently, it gave it the texture and the quality. It was an identifying feature. And because a lim me'odamim would be necessary for the Mishkan, these, the orot, a lim me'odamim, the skins, it would be necessary to slaughter an animal or two in order to skin the animal and have these skins ready to make the various curtains, the parochet, in the Mishkan. So the Gemara says there, Ma elim parim veravim. How do elim, rams, procreate? They procreate with males and females. Parim veravim, pruvu, af kol shepara verava. Only animals that reproduce with males and females are forbidden to kill those animals on Shabbat. Was the elim me'odamim becomes what's called in the halachic language a binyan av, or a blueprint for other examples. And you have this often in Torah Shabbat Peh. The Torah talks about one example, but then Chazal say it means all the others in this general category as well. It's not just this one that's mentioned right here. So now the Torah Shabbat Peh, the oral law, has expanded the prohibition of killing organisms and animals on Shabbat, Balei Chayim, for those that reproduce with males and females. V'kina, or v'china, the lice, eina para verava. The reproductive process is not with male and female, ela mibsar adam hi shoretzet. it develops from the flesh of human beings. What does that mean?
Spontaneous generation.
It means spontaneous generation. Absolutely. And let's take a look at the Rambam. And nobody's going to accuse the Rambam of not being a scientist, right? Source number three. Hamafaleh chilav b'shabbat. If you're somehow, you're moving around, you have all kinds of kelim, and you're adjusting something. Molel et hakinim v'zorkan. So let's assume there are lice in the area, you'll have to shove them away. Umutar laharog et hakinim b'shabbat. You're actually permitted to kill the lice on Shabbat. Mipnei shehein min hazeah. They come from the sweat of human beings. They come from sweat. This is what the Rambam says. Now we're going to see some treatment in a moment of how the modern day halachas view this. Because we know today that that's not true. And if it's not true, how does that impact on the halacha? For example, I'll give an example. The mashal is not 100% domel in mashal, but I get this shayla all the time. A person passes away in Chutz Laaretz, let's say in the area of New York, and they bring the body to Kfura in Beit Shemesh, right? In Eretz Achayim. Some of the family comes, some of the family stays behind. When does the family who stay behind begin to sit shiva? When did it begin to sit shiva? So I'm hearing two voices here. That's good. The minhag is, as soon as they leave the airport and part with the body, they go home and start sitting shiva, which many times means that the family that's sitting shiva in America get up from shiva a day earlier because they most probably will have been able to sit an hour before sundown, whereas the other party is going to wait till the flight gets to Israel and make the kfura and then begin the shiva the next day, because shiva begins after the kfura. That's the thing. Shiva begins there. Before the shiva, before the kfura, before the burial, there's no shiva. So there's a Rambam. Again, Rambam is in the 13th, in the 12th century, right? So what does the Rambam write? He writes, he doesn't know about Kennedy Airport, but he writes about the ports. That if a body is being sent for burial overseas, then the family who parts with the body from the port starts sitting shiva immediately. And he says, "Bipnei, because they don't know when the kfura will be." That's what the Rambam says. Because they won't know when the kfura will be, so what are they going to do? Just arbitrarily say they'll start sitting shiva in 3 weeks. They don't know. You don't know. So for all practical purposes, the body's been buried, even though physically it wasn't buried yet. But from the point of view of the avelim, the mourners, it's already a burial. There was parting, and so on. That was written 850 years ago, and it was certainly true. Today, life is very different. They put a body on an airplane on Kennedy Airport, and all I have to do is do flight tracker and on the phone, and you know exactly when that plane's going to land in Israel, and you estimate an hour and a half, 2 hours after the plane lands, they're going to be in Beit Shemesh for a levaya. So if the plane lands on the LL002 flight, it lands at 12:25, so you can figure by 2:30 in the afternoon, there's a kfura. And you don't have to even figure. You dial up the person. In all likelihood, somebody's going to have the phone on some Skype, and they're going to Skype the levaya here in Israel so that the avelim and the chutz laaretz should be able to see what's going on. You have the exact second of when the kfura ends, no different than the people in Beit Shemesh who are there. So should the avelut wait until the moment of kfura? Because the Rambam says you sit shiva after you leave the port because we don't know when the kfura was. Now you don't have to be a Reb Chaim Soloveitchik from Brisk to figure this one out. That what would the Rambam's opinion today be on the subject? I think it's so clear. Yet, most poskim will tell the family today in Chutz Laaretz, you leave the airport, you parted with the body, you start sitting shiva. Why is that so? For two reasons. One is, okay, so the Rambam said what he said. But maybe Rambam said what he said as a nice explanation, but it's not the absolute explanation. It could be that the idea that when one leaves the body, that really becomes kvura from their point of view. And avelut, mourning, kicks in at that moment, whether or not you know when the actual burial will take place in fact. And because for so many years, centuries, this has been the practice, so many, many Rabbanim today shudder to think that they're going to suggest something that the Neid Behuda and the Chassam Sofer and Rabbi Kiva Eger in the 19th century or in the 16th century or 17th century thought otherwise. They won't do it. And they'll say, listen, it's possible that this opinion still exists today, and there is a principle in the laws of Evel, halacha kedivrei hamekel be'evel. That is a halachic axiom, that if there are two opinions in the laws of Evel, we adopt the opinion of the lenient party, no matter who the lenient is. Why? And that has to do with the fact that we know that avelut is hard, and you know, sometimes people are not youngsters sitting shiva. The halakha tries to accommodate as much as possible to make it, as hard as it is, a trifle easier. There's no mitzvah to make it more difficult than it could be halachically. So on that score, there is this concept called halacha kedivrei hamekel be'evel. And being that that's the case, many rabbanim will say, look, getting up a day earlier from shiva is a kula, is a leniency. You know, just have to wait around another day in limbo and then start sitting shiva and then ending it, you know, a day later, that becomes a little bit more of a burden. And that's the basis why Rabbanim today will almost ignore what the Rambam says as a definitive explanation. And we'll try to read into the words that it's not definitive explanation. It's just we call it in the language of the yeshiva, svara. It's a nice logic, but it's not absolute. And we can argue with it, and so on. So here you have a very, very good example of where the circumstance has clearly changed, and that circumstance that used to be was, according to the Rambam, the basis of a particular psak halacha, and it really should adjust itself today, yet many of Rabbanim are very, very scared to do so. And there's another reason they're scared to do so, or they won't do it, is because of the Chatam Sofer's dictum in the 19th century in his fight against Reform Judaism, lifting out of context a few words of a Mishnah from a Masechet Orla, and has nothing to do with the Mishnah in Orla, but the phrase is Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. If it's new, it's forbidden. The context is the prohibition of eating new grain, the fresh grain from the new year, Chodosh, what's called in Halacha, the Tvoah HaDashah, before the offering of the Korban HaOmer. So there's a whole dispute whether the prohibition of eating Chodosh is limited to Eretz Yisrael or it's universal. So the Mishnah expresses an opinion that it's throughout the world, Chadash, Asur Min HaTorah B'chol Makom, that the prohibition of Chadash is relevant no matter where you are in the world. Chadash Asur Min HaTorah B'chol Makom. What the Chassam Sofer did with this, he did a cut and paste. He lifted it out of context and said, Chadash, if it's new, it's prohibited. Asur Min HaTorah. Yeah.
Taking pills today, people used to blind.
Yefemot. The question is taking medication on Shabbat. Taking medication on Shabbat is a rabbinic prohibition that it might lead to grinding. So tochein is one of those 11, you know, making your bread, grinding the wheat. And in days of old, medication meant taking herbs, and you didn't, you know, swallow the herbs. You ground them down into some type of, you know, powdered form of some sort. So it was the grinding that was really the issue at hand. So, you know, you may say, well, second, I have it prepared from yesterday and from Thursday. You know, I have a box and it says Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, right? I have my pill box. And So a person so a person's not going to grind on Shabbat. It's all prepared. But Chazal, they took into consideration all peoples, and not everybody pre-grinds or pre-ground their herbs, and it might lead to grinding the herbs on Shabbat, which would be prohibited. Today, this is antiquated. Nobody grinds herbs anymore to take a medication. You just take a pill. It's as simple as that. Yeah, Baksha. So the problem of Batal HaTam, Batal HaGzeira, the reason is lost, so let's just undo the Gzeira, is problematic because a Gzeira, a prohibition or restriction, rabbinic restriction, that has successfully kicked in, has become accepted by Am Yisrael, you have to have a Sanhedrin of greater judges, Gadol B'Chokhmah B'Minyan, to undo the Gzeira. So the real issue today is technical. We don't have the halachic mechanism to really undo it. But what do we have? We have halachic authority to be matir, to permit an isa d'rabbanan in every single case that a rav deems necessary. So instead of getting up in the shul and saying, mikan al haba, from now on, you know, all your pills are okay on Shabbat. No, what we do is, we ask a shayla. You know, I have to take antibiotics for 10 days. As far as I know, in a 10-day period, there's going to be at least one Shabbat. Doctor says you have to take it at the same hour, in the morning and the evening. And if you don't take it, it messes up the dosage. And that's true, by the way. That's not just a vart, but it's true. It's correct pharmacology. So the Rav will say, okay, you know, your case, you know, you can take the pill in the morning and the evening. Fine. And 5 minutes later, another person comes with a similar shayla, and the Rav will say, in your case, you can take the pill in the morning and the evening. So everybody has a private case. What it ends up with is that everybody's popping pills on Shabbat. Because if you are given pills to regulate your sugar, to regulate your heart, to regulate your blood pressure, any of these pills that you're taking on an ongoing basis every single day, ad me'vesrim u'shtayim shana, right? You're going to keep taking them. You're not going to not take them on Shabbat. Because that's, if you know anything about the endocrinology, that's not good for you. It's not good for you at all. And you're certainly not allowed to jeopardize your health. So because not taking the pills could be injurious to your health, so therefore, so you don't have to, every Friday, you don't have to call a rav every Friday, you know. You know that you're taking pills already, so, as I say, alaykilatchem, it's on me. You can take your pills. Doctor told you to take pills every day. Take your pills. Correct. But we know that there's still an issue. So when do we keep the gzeira? If I had a headache at 3 in the afternoon, and I know Shabbos ends at 5:15, and should I run for the Akamol right now? Or can I hold out for 2 hours before I take the Akamol? So I would hold out for the 2 hours before I pop the Akamol, even though I can tell you honestly, there are pills that I'm taking every single day. So those are pills that regulate whatever they're regulating. But an Akamol, you know, a painkiller, you know, not. Or for example, the Rav said over and over that if a person has a din of a choyle, now what does a choyle mean? You know, people have chronic illnesses, but they're Baruch Hashem walking around. I know people who are sick, but they're not laid up in bed in the hospital or home. They're functioning. They're going to work. So that's not considered a chayla for a particular moment. A chayla is somebody who's, you know, bedridden, hospital ridden, high fever, or a migraine headache that, you know, you just can't walk around. You know, you're dizzy. That's a chayla. So for such cholim, there are no rabbinic restrictions at all. There's a blank check. That, you know, do what you have to do if you have to violate a rabbinic prohibition. Fine. So that we understand also has to do with, let's assume a person has a major tendonitis attack and his foot is killing him and he can't walk and it's Friday night. And you're not going to, you know, you can't bear the pain for the end of Shabbos. But you have to have, something that's gonna work, an anti-inflammatory something. You pop a pill, and within an hour, you're gonna start sensing relief. So am I going to be the rough to tell the person, no, suffer through Shabbos? Be the last to tell him that. Because that person is debilitated. Can't move. He's stuck. So again, these are situations where you have to use your judgment and a lot of common sense here. And then more often than not, you're being matir. So I agree that when there'll be a Sanhedrin, and we daven for the Sanhedrin 3 times a day, Hashiva Shofteinu Kvarishona V'Yotzeinu Kvatchila. I have a list already of certain things that I'd like the Sanhedrin to put on the agenda. One of them is, all right, let's just officially call off this gzeira on medication on Shabbat. Let's call it off for this very reason. I mean, I have a few other things like, why wait till Zion Cheshvan to say Mashavurach for Talumatel the Bracha in Eretz Yisrael? Zion Cheshvan. What, are we still concerned about those who came for Aliyah LeRegel on Sukkot, who live near the Euphrates River, and they're going to be stuck in the mud 15 days after Sukkot? Who's worried about them today? Forget about Yimon HaMashiach. Nobody's going to be concerned about that. Because if somebody's going to be living in Syria by the Euphrates River and wants to come on Aliyah LeRegel to Bayit Shlishi, you know, it's about a day's travel, and most probably there'll be a flight to the reopen Atarot Airport, and there'll be a short flight, and you know, you can hire my son who'll be happy to fly you, and shine. You'll be there in an hour, in an hour, not 15 days. And so, that's what's going to happen. There are going to be adjustments in the halakha because of some of these changes in reality. Certainly, Beit Din HaGadol can take all this into consideration. So let's take a look at source 4. Source 4 tells us a story, which I remember hearing about this. I didn't learn it inside the Gemara, but I had a Rebbe in 11th grade in Kamenetz Yeshiva Borough Park who was overjoyed by this Gemara, and I can tell you in a moment which side he took. He didn't take the science side. And Chachmei Yisrael Omrim, the wise men of Am Yisrael said, Bayom, in the daytime, Hama mahalechet limata minarakia. The sun travels under the atmosphere, under the sky. That's why we see the sun, because the atmosphere is above. This is the understanding, is above the sunshine, and it's going from east to west. Ubalaila. So why is it nighttime? Balaila limala minarakia. The sun takes a reverse track and goes back from west to east, but goes above the Rakia, and hence you don't see it, so that's why it's dark. The Rakia blocks out the sunshine. Now this takes into consideration that the world is flat, and that the sun is the one, the body that's in motion. And there's an opposite direction of at nighttime. This is the Chachmei Yisrael. Chachmei Umot Olam, but the Goyim, who are the Goyim? Who are the Goyim? Greek scientists. They say, no. Bayom, chama mehalechet lemata min harakia. The sun, they agree that that's why we see the sunshine in the daytime. Ubalayla continues in the same direction, the sun motion, but it's lemata min hakarka. So even assuming they believe the world is flat, but the sun then, when it gets to the west, we call shkiata chama, the sunset, it continues under the ground and then pipes up in the morning with sunrise. Ubalayla lemata min hakarka. Omar Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, this is Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, nir'in divrehen midivreinu. The Goyim got it right. They have it right. Now, they have it right. They actually have it wrong also. They also have it wrong. But they have it righter. Right, two wrongs make it right. They have it right. They have it more right than our Chachamim. Why? But what's the Sfarad? This is really cute. Shebayom, in the daytime, Mayanot, the water of the springs, Tzonanim, they're cold. Ubalayla, in the nighttime, Rotchim, which means it's like the sun on the bottom is like the kirayim, it's the stove, and the heat is coming up from under the karka, and heating up the waters in the spring. But at daytime, the sunshine is too far away. It's not going to heat up the sunshine. It's not going to heat up the water. Daytime, the waters are cold. Why are the waters cold in the daytime and warmer at night? You go to the yam, or even an open air swimming pool in the summer. The water is going to be a little warmer in nighttime. What does it mean? It is. Why does it get cold in the morning? Why is it cold in the morning? What happens to the heat? Right. The heat dissipates. We know that. We know that the sunlight does not directly heat the earth. It provides light and heat, but it warms up the earth. And the earth then radiates heat at nighttime. And that radiation of heat by the earth is what gives the springs the heated water. Now this they didn't have a clue about, the Goyim or the Jews. Now, the sun, you know, continuing under the karka. So again, they're assuming that the planet Earth is flat, and they're assuming that the planet Earth is stationary, and they're assuming that the sun is the body that's in motion, going from east to west. And the fact that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi makes a statement, "I think they have it right over us," is extremely important, because this kind of scientific statement of our Chachamim is not something that's halacha l'Moshe Mesinai. It's not part of the Masorah. It's not part of the tradition of what Torah is all about. It's independently arrived at conclusion based on the science of the day. And Rabbi Yehuda Nasi said, it's possible that the Umot Olam have it right and we have it wrong. And there's nothing wrong with that. Just as there's nothing wrong with saying they all had it wrong. And the whole thing is wrong. The whole thing is completely, completely wrong. Now the question is, if you had a halakha that's based on any of this information, then you're going to be in deep trouble. In deep, deep trouble. Because we know that this is not correct. Now, I teach once a week at the Herzog College, which is part of Yeshiva Taratzion, the Herzog, and so on. But right down the block, in Hechash Lomo, they have the campus for Tosh and E. And there's a group, there's a program, and I'm saying this l'shvach, not l'gnai. It's a wonderful program of women who are Haredi women in the Beit Yaakov system who are going to Mechlelet Herzog. Now that's something which is an eye-opener and a revolution to upgrade their status. They're doing it because they're going to get a better salary at the end of the day and they have to support their husbands who are sitting in koilels. That doesn't bother me at all. The fact that they're coming to Mechlelet Herzog and studying is a remarkable development, by the way. And I had a student last year, and this came up in a class that I gave that related to science and the Torah, and she staunchly said that if the Gemara says Chachmei Yisrael Oimrim, that's the way it is. So, you know, Copernicus can jump on his head. And not gonna didn't phase her. And I tried in various ways to try to explain to her that it's not apikorsis to believe that the earth is round. And I said, if you're interested, we can put you on the space shuttle, and you'll make a revolution around planet Earth in 90 minutes, in an hour and a half, you do an orbit in outer space. And you can see with your own eyes that the earth is not flat, and not only that, if you do just a trifle basic study of astronomy, you discover that it's not the sun that's going from east to west. It's the earth that's moving. And that's why it appears to us as if the sun is rising. That doesn't mean the sun is not in motion. Everything is in motion. The sun is also rotating on its axis, but the earth with the other eight planets are revolving around the sun, and the entire solar system is also in motion as part of a galaxy. And the galaxy is in motion as part of a greater. I mean, it's hard to fathom what we are. And that's why David HaMelech said, Ki eresh amecha ma'aseh etzbotecha, yereach v'kochachvim masher konanta, ma'enosh ki tizkerenu, ven adam ki tifkedenu. just gaze at the astronomy, and you'll realize how small you've become. Well, as the Rav put it in The Lonely Man of Faith, cosmic dust. It's very, very complimentary. Cosmic dust. Avak mer kosmos. Yeah. Okay, we have a few minutes to touch on source number 5. It looks like long, but we're going to be able to... This was a question that was asked to Rav Herzog. Rav Herzog was the second Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. He was appointed in 1936-37, after Rav Kook passed away in 1935. He was a Rav in Dublin, Ireland. Since a phenomenal personality, tremendous Talmud Chacham, and an academician as well. He had a doctorate. He did his doctorate, by the way, on the question of the Tchelet, which is a subject that I'd like to do here as well. And we'll talk about Rav Herzog. Here the question came by the Strauss milk firm in Nahariya. So, you go into the supermarket or Makolet and you see the Strauss milk products, yogurts and all kinds of other chazarai they have and so on. There was a guy, Mr. Strauss, and he founded the company. And what they were doing was, they were putting basically penicillin, which is microorganisms, into the pail that would milk the cows to destroy bacteria. Penicillin destroys bacteria, and they would put penicillin on the line, the bottom of the pails that would catch the milk, in the milking process. This is way before they had machines that would milk the cows. It still was done by hand. You go to certain kibbutzim, you can still see it. And the question was whether you could do this on Shabbat, whether the killing of the chaydakim, the microorganisms, these would be prohibited because of hariga nitilat neshama on Shabbat. This was the shayla. Hashmadat chaydakim b'Shabbat, shayla, in source number 5. Im mutar b'Shabbat lo sif chomer mashmid. Can you add this type of agent that's mashmid chaydakim, destroys bacteria, l'toch kelim shecholvim bahem, to the pails that the cows will milk. B'terem shecholvim, before the cows will milk, k'dei limnoa hitztabrut chaydakim mazikim. Because the idea was, as the milk was spilling into the pail, whatever bacteria might be, they're being knocked off before any type of colony of bacteria could even develop. Tshuva, response. Baruch Hashem, Kaf Hei Tammuz, Tavshin Hei. Means the summer of 1945. Rav Herzog is answering this. Binyan HaSheila Shutza Ayde Professor Strauss, Nero Yair, Yom Yud Zayin Tammuz, Tavshin Hei. Hasafek shit orer vevi lidei hashelag. What's the doubt? What kanirech shashel isur netilat neshama? They were worried that the killing of the microorganisms would be prohibited on Shabbat. Avol l'chora in kan shum chash. Rav Herzog says, 1 second, there's no issue here. Ki arei mutar larok kina b'Shabbat mipnei sheina parav rava. You're allowed to kill the lice on Shabbat because they do not procreate. What we saw already earlier. Ki muvuar b'masechet Shabbat. And that is shakina, the lice, kevan she'ena ba mizahar nekeva, do not come from a sexual union of male and female. Ela min hazea, paraphrasing the Rambam, comes from the sweat. Eino chashuva birya, it's not considered an organism. Linyan ze, for this purpose, lesor harigata b'Shabbat. So while we may call it an organism, the halacha doesn't call it an organism, and hence there's no prohibition of killing it on Shabbat. Ubenegele parosh, parosh also type of lice and paroshim also insects. Shechayav al harigata, on certain insects you are obligated, you are responsible if you kill them on Shabbat. Avshagam hu eina parav rava. So Rav Herzog says, yeah, but there's a thing called parosh. There's certain insects that also do not procreate with male and female. And nevertheless, they're prohibited on Shabbat to kill them. Mikol makom, kevan shehaviatan min afar, yesh ba chiyut. But they come from the ground. So there's some life to them, so they're considered organisms. Ki'ilu nivra mizachar nekeva, as if they were created from male and female. Ulefikach yesh barigata isur shel netilat neshama b'Shabbat. That's why killing these insects would be prohibited on Shabbat. Omnam, however, hamada hechadash, the modern science, kifi shiyadua li. Now, Rav Herzog was not a backwards person. This man was university educated. Einena mode be, and he uses a Latin term here, which is clearly spontaneous generation. He's writing it in Latin. Spontaneous generation. Does not believe in it. Now, since when do we stop believing it? Enrico Fermi. Enrico Fermi was an Italian scientist who did a very simple experiment. Took three jars, and he put a piece of meat in the three jars, let the meat decay a little bit, and close one solid, I mean sealed, as they say, skira hermetet, totally solid. The other had a cover, but it was loosely covered, and the other one was open. And it came back, you know, a day later, 3 days later, 7 days later, and the one that was loosely, that was completely opened, was full of maggots, full of maggots. The one that was partially closed had some maggots, and the one that was totally sealed, that we call vacuum-packed, had zero maggots. And therefore, it showed that the maggots, these insects, these creeping things, did not come from the meat. And that was one of his great experiments. There's no such thing as spontaneous generation. And it took some modern science a while to figure out. So how do they procreate? There's asexual reproduction. How does Amoebium and Paramoebia, you know, reproduce themselves? So, if you're not familiar with it and you didn't study it in school, tune into National Geographic and you'll see it. They have programs today to educate about all kinds of basic things in science, and you can see it happening. I remember once Rav Tendler gave a shiur here in Yerushalayim to RCA rabbis. So RCA rabbis are generally retired rabbis. That's why sometimes I'm embarrassed to show up at the RCA programs, because you're supposed to be a retired rabbi and usually way above my age to participate. But that's okay. It's very nice to keep busy at RCA rabbi. And Rav Tendler gave a lecture, and he said something, I'm trying to remember what it was, about, I think it had to do with DNA identification, which we use today in the police and in the army to positively identify people by using DNA. And as the lecture is going on and on and on, an elderly rabbi raises his hands and asks Rabbi Tendler, "What's DNA?" And Rabbi Tendler exploded. I felt bad for this rabbi. I felt bad because Rabbi Tendler was in the middle of a sentence. The timing was bad. And he just was caught so off guard. He basically said, "Well, you go back to school and you'll learn what DNA is." You're like, "Okay, Maseda." He apologized afterwards, but it was, I mean, I myself was taken aback because I was at that lecture. And to ask, what is DNA? I didn't expect anybody in the room to know that it's deoxyribose nucleic acids and to understand the spiral, you know, how it's built and that how many chromosomes it has and how many genes each chromosome carries, and expect them to, you know, to be on that level. But not to have heard of of DNA and to know that it's unique for every particular individual, much better than a fingerprint. And that indeed, if you have a sliver of a human being, a piece of bone, a piece of skin, you can positively identify a victim, and it's done today, and so on. So we just have to assume that we know things. And I find with my students, in the Haredi students in Herzog, they're missing a lot of these basics. A lot of, I'm talking like, you know, I expect anybody that's in a college today to know these things, then I have to take three steps back and go back to fourth grade science. And it's like Bresh's Bar, like it's a revelation. And they're very suspicious of me because, you know, I'm Nebuchadnezzar. So, you know, who knows what I'm trying to sell them under the table there. It's a real issue of trying to make up lost ground in basic scientific information. So according to Rav Herzog, you know, he says that modern science has disregarded spontaneous generation, אבל אנו אין לנו לעניין הלכה אלא דברי חז"ל. Okay, fine. So the scientists say what they're saying, but we just have the information of Chazal. Ulefi zeh, therefore, vaday shemutar larok chaydakim b'shabbat afilu einam mazikim. If they injure, that's something else. But if they, even if they don't injure, there's no problem killing microorganisms. Ubefrat shebehem gam hamada mudeh she'ein itrabut shelhem ba b'derek piriya v'rivya b'muvan haragil shel habitui hazeh. Because here he's banking on science, that he says, we know that these microcosmic organisms do not reproduce in a normal male-female way. What Rav Herzog goes on to say, and by the way, there's another issue here. Something that's not, you can't see it with your eye, is not prohibited at all. And you need a microscope to see bacteria. So he says that's another reason that it's mutar. And then he goes on to say that it may be, it's not just permissible to do this, but it might be a chiyuv, an obligation, to try to kill the bacteria, because there's a public health issue here, and you don't want this milk that's contaminated to make it to the market. So there's a long-range public health. And then he raises at the end of the tshuva, the last paragraph, that he consulted with his colleague, the Sephardi chief rabbi, who was Rab Uziel, Rab Ben Zion Uziel, And he asked him what he thought of this, and Rav Uziel mentioned that maybe there's a problem of bishul, that when, where's the bishul? That when the milk hits the pesticide, that it's going to cause a certain chemical reaction there that might be similar to bishul. So Rav Herzog then calls up Dr. Strauss and he verifies that none of these chemical reactions are taking place, and at the bottom line is, he says that it is permissible to do this. Now, I heard Rabbi Tendler in class on the subject of Kinim B'Shabbat, and he took issue with his co-author, Professor Dr. Fred Rosner. He's a very, very known doctor. I had the pleasure of teaching his grandchildren in Chash Benoim. So Fred Rosner and Rabbi Tendler, they wrote books together on all kinds of medical issues. And Dr. Fred Rosner says unequivocally that the Rambam would change this line of source number 3. He would change it and most probably would prohibit the killing of kinim on Shabbat today. Would prohibit it. Would not permit, because if the permissibility is based on spontaneous generation, and we know that doesn't exist, so we have to go back now and say that Chazal would prohibit it. And Rabbi Tendler said, it took more of a line of Rav Herzog here, and he says, all right, so the nimuk, the reason, the rationale of the Rambam is wrong, but the halakha still remains the halakha. We have to scratch our heads, if you have kinim or not, and figure out another reason why it would be permissible. But the reasons is just an add-on to the fulfillment of the halakha. The halakha remains an axiom. And permissibility means permissibility, and that's the way it's going to stand. So you have two people who respect each other greatly, are co-authors of books on medical ethics, and they took issue on this issue of how do you know what the Rambam would have done? I don't know. But what would the Rambam have done in the 21st century, knowing what we know today about this particular halakha? So Dr. Rosner thinks for sure Rambam would change his mind. And my daughter agrees with that, by the way. She also thinks the Rambam would have changed his mind on this. But Rabbi Tendler says that Rambam certainly would have admitted there's no spontaneous generation. He would not have gone along with saying, no, the scientists are wrong. That for sure not. But he would have kept the halakha as is, perhaps supplying some alternative understanding of what governed this. So this is really an interesting case. Okay, next week in Mitzvah Shem is Hanukkah. We will have a shir. And the week after is also Hanukkah. We have 2 weeks of Hanukkah. So I usually digress from the normal topic, and I'll give some shirim that are Hanukkah related. Okay.